and welcome to Talking Dirty at the Library, where we'll talk about what's growing here in Athens and Limestone County, Alabama. Each podcast features master gardener experts discussing ways we can cultivate better gardens and better lifestyles through local gardening programs.
Hello, everyone. My name is Emily Clem, and this is Talking Dirty at the Library. Today, we have Lynn Winokur, who has just given a presentation at our usual second Tuesday, Getting Dirty at the Library. Lynn is the curator of the herbarium at Alabama A&M. Okay, some of us, when we heard herbarium, thought about terrariums. Well, that's not anything like what a herbarium is. I mean, the terrarium that you might make in an old 2-liter Coke bottle or your kid might bring home from school, that is not what we're talking about. So, Lynn, give us a quick rundown. What is it herbarium or herbarium, first of all?
It's an herbarium.
Herbarium.
Yes.
Okay. So what is an herbarium?
That is a plant library, but these plants are not alive. They are pressed and preserved for perpetuity into a special case in a special room or rooms, usually on a university or college campus.
Okay. To me, because my son is into insects, it sounds like his insect collection. It is sort of the same thing, because insect collections and your herbarium are used for what?
Mostly research, also for teaching. Those are two of the major applications that we utilize herbaria for. But herbaria collections are used in forensic science for solving crime.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're used in medicine to see where those plants are in a particular location. There's just a lot of different applications.
It also makes me remember when I took an ornithology class at UNA, they had a collection of preserved birds. Many of them were shot sometime around the turn of the century, and maybe even before 1900, because that's what they did then. And then they were preserved and they were in drawers. And that helped me learn my birds, because I could pull a drawer out, I could look closely at a specimen and see what it looked like, much easier than if you were looking through binoculars at something in a tree.
That's the beauty of having things stored in a museum-type setting, because they're protected and you can actually look at, okay, like your birds. This is what this bird was like, say, in the 1940s. Well, we may not be shooting those birds today, but we have other ways of doing the research and capturing them while they're alive. We do that at Alabama A&M in our department. But we can still make those comparisons. Are there changes over time? So
yes,
that's the value of these sorts of collections.
And just to clarify, our ornithology professor at UNA would encourage us to bring in, like if we found where a bird hit a window, bring it in and he would make it part of the collection. He had a process where he freeze-dried the body. Okay, back to plants. I didn't mean to go down this little rabbit trail there about birds, but it's the same concept. Is that to learn about plants, birds, insects, to be able to look at specimens is a great way to learn.
There's a connection there, though, Emily. I did a study at the bird feature out on Chapman Mountain. I matched the species of plants to the bird species and their use of those plants out on the property. That's valuable research. Community connections when we're quickly losing prime forest land and other managed properties to urbanization. So there are all kind of applications between those insects, those birds, and the plants.
Yes, yes. And I have, over the last 10 years, cultivated native species in my yard. And the change in the bird population is obvious. Okay, so an herbarium is a collection of plants dried and preserved into perpetuity. At A&M, there's a big forestry department and agricultural department. Talk a little bit about how they use your herbarium.
Well, the professors, I actually work in the program known as the Forestry, Ecology, and Wildlife Program. It's a specialized program at Alabama A&M University, specifically for students who plan to become future foresters. These students work with foresters during their whole career in college and have the opportunity to have their first job with the forestry service.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard sometimes to find your first job, and this program is a wonderful program. We also have lots of professors working with medicinals, with environmental remediation, looking at carbon dioxide sequestration. In fact, Alabama A&M University has a plot out at Paint Rock that we're looking at. It's called the Forest Geo. We're part of the Forest Geo program, but we're looking at carbon dioxide sequestration. It's a 50-year study. We've just completed our first survey, thousands of stems of trees. And starting this coming semester, we will start our second census of those trees. So it's a fabulous program. We're taking applications right now for students. They just need to contact that program at Alabama A&M University. We have a farm, an 8-acre farm.
I've been there. I've been there to see the birds.
And you know, a lot of people will drive down the highway and look over and think, well, there's not much going on over there. Why are they growing all those trees and not doing anything with them? Well, actually, I've been part of at least two teams that have measured almost all of those trees out there. Those are growth studies.
Okay.
I've also, in the last two or three years, been involved with a goat project. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Little male goats, using them in silvopasture to help keep the ground underneath the growing timber
clear. So silvopasture means that you are letting them pasture in a forest or woodland.
Or in a managed property. Just putting goats in there to keep the vegetation down to a level where you don't have to come in and mow all the time.
Or burn. Yeah.
And so all kinds of applications. But we also have an environmental education program. There are horticultural opportunities there. Alabama A&M is an extremely old university with some top-notch scientists.
And we don't always hear about that, so that's good to know. Are there other herbariums in the state?
Yes. Auburn University probably has the largest or the second largest in the state, the University of Alabama, UNA, University of West Alabama. We have a small one at Alabama A&M University. It's just now being put together. I'm guessing we probably have about 1,500 species. And most of those are from our own research. Students who've done a doctoral study or a master's thesis, or some of the professors are into medicinal studies, agricultural applications, plants, where we study things like princess tree and tree of heaven, and bush honeysuckle.
Isn't it interesting that those horrible invasive species have such beautiful names?
Well, you know, that's how we sell things.
Oh, true.
You find the most sellable characteristic of whatever it is you want to sell, and you name it in a way that's going to draw attention to the potential buyer.
So when you find a specimen that you want to be part of your collection, tell us how that goes. You start with your boot zone, right?
It's not super dramatic. You get up at the crack of dawn. Before the sun comes up, usually, because you collect during the growing season.
Mm-hmm.
In Alabama, and even here in North Alabama, our growing season is most of the year. I have collected henbit in the cold of February and in January and in December. And I've not been out 1 month of the year that I haven't collected something. I do a lot of work for particular individuals or groups. Like I do a good bit of work with the Land Trust of North Alabama. They just got acquisition to their, it's the 10th or the 11th preserve up here in North Alabama.
That's great.
And so I am always looking for new species to document. knowing what you have and knowing what role it plays in a particular habitat. For the kind of things I do, it often opens up opportunities for receiving grants for land management or other opportunities to protect these habitats. Sometimes it opens up opportunities for us to acquire funding to eradicate a non-native invasive species like Chinese privet or bush honeysuckle. Or it's getting to be things like Nandina and Mahonia. Even crepe myrtle is becoming a problem. Mm-hmm. And people say, well, it's not a problem in my yard. No, because you are a gardener and you maintain and manage your yard. But the birds, I feed 42 species. I can't tell them, you can't take that to the woods with you when you go. They are going to eat it. They're going to go land on a limb somewhere, probably in a forest somewhere, and roost over the night and drop their food waste somewhere. Mm-hmm. And if that food waste lands on a soil that's conducive to growth, that's how we run into
environmental problems.
Yes. And the problem with that is you've got your tools at home. Sometimes these infestations are on top of a mountain or down in a river or on a floodplain that's flooded 5 months out of the year. And so the opportune times for reaching these infestations sometimes very hard to acquire.
I've been in the Bankhead pulling up privet.
Yep.
Yep. So you find the plant you want. You don't just pull it up and put it in a shoebox. Tell us what you do.
Well, I have a handy little hand shovel, a trowel. I also have clippers. Sometimes it's lopping shears. Sometimes I have to get out my trusted little saw. And I utilize the rules, regulations, if you will call it, for how to collect in the field. You don't just pull a great big old plant up out of the woods and take it to the herbarium, see if you can get that tree in that case. All we want to do is document the presence. We also want to document the life cycle. Say I have a particular ginger in the herbarium, but I have it only for the month that it's emerging. So I only have it in the vegetative state. I don't have the flower or I don't have the fruit. In an ideal world, you want all of that because that's the complete life cycle. And that helps us understand the plant. It's the main reason why we're going to collect. We want a historical document. We want to know where that plant fits in the habitat that it's in. And we also want to collect it in all the habitats where we find it, if that's possible. So it's not something that happens in one day. And sometimes we'll run across a species that we think is a particular plant. And we're going to collect it because maybe it's in a different habitat than we've ever seen it before. Well, lo and behold, it might turn out to be a brand new species. Oftentimes, we're not out in the field to find that new species. But that's something we're always prepared to find.
And you don't know it until you bring it back and look at all those little very details, even run DNA on it.
Sometimes you don't. We do have some extremely astute botanists and professors across this country and this world who can look at something and go, yeah, that's a newbie.
Yep.
You know, and those are the people that we look to, our gurus. Can't do without them.
In your presentation, you showed us a press. So the main job of that press is to get the moisture out because we all know what happens. I can remember putting leaves or maybe a corsage from the prom in a book and pressing it and coming back in a few weeks and ta-da, it's not only molded itself, it's got mold on the book.
And you can't save it.
Nope, then you might as well dump it. So you have a process that avoids that.
Right. So once we've collected the plant, we clean it up in the field. We get as much of the soil off because that soil still contains seeds of that community. We don't need those. We don't want those. We want to get as much of that off. There may also be insect eggs and things of that nature. So the cleaning process, and sometimes that involves putting the roots down in the water and swashing it around and shaking those roots off, drying them off with paper towels because you want to get as much moisture off that plant. But then we place those plants in special containers. All of us have a little bit different technique. I work up here in the hot south, and so if I'm out collecting in the summer, I probably will have a large cooler. I put ice blocks down in the bottom of that, and I lay a plastic garbage bag over the top of that because I don't want the water hitting the plants.
Right.
But I also carry the large storage bags, freezer storage bags. Mm-hmm. That way, when I get my plant prepped, I can fold it without breaking it and place it in that bag, and then I'll blow some CO2 into it, label what it is, and put it in the bag and put that bag in the freezer. I try not to collect more plants than I can actually process in a day's time because we're looking for museum quality stuff, not, you know, something that I can remember when I was a child. The first flower I ever collected for my grandmother was the blue toad flax. And of course, I'm coming home from school, so I pull it up out of the ground, knock the dirt off of it, and I've got it in my hand, and I'm walking about a quarter of a mile. By the time she gets it, they're all drooped over and everything. So that's the purpose of the plastic, is to keep them looking fresh and make them think they're alive. I get them home, and immediately, if possible, I process them into that press. And that press is designed to move moisture from the plant back out into the atmosphere.
And let me describe this press a little bit. It's layers of cardboard, corrugated cardboard, and wood on the outside, and then belts to tighten it to increase the pressure. And I actually have one, not that good one. So the idea is get all that moisture out because a dried specimen can last a long time.
Forever, if it's stored properly.
Yes, and I noticed you said the humidity in the room where the herbarium is only 40%.
Anywhere from maybe 40 to 60%.
Mm-hmm. Where here in Alabama, it's not
unusual. It's hard keeping that.
Yes,
to keep our plants from molding.
It is not unusual for us to have 80, 90% humidity here.
So most of the really good herbaria, up-to-date herbaria, have climate-controlled thermostat. Mm-hmm. But yes, that plant press, it's well-designed. It works. And then from there, they come out of the press. The plants are mounted on what we call an herbarium card, using a particular set of guidelines to mount that. It should be a piece of art when it's finished. Then there's a label put in the bottom right-hand corner of that card that has all of the information that you've collected about that specimen. Mm-hmm. The herbarium has its own logo, a stamp that it uses.
I saw that. I saw that in one of your pictures.
And we all have our own acronym. So the New York Botanical Gardens stores all the information. It's called Index Herbariorum. And so all of the herbaria in the world are listed there. So Alabama A&M has its own acronym. It's AAMU.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very small. We're not even on the...
Still, small is important.
We're small, but it's
You're
very
still
important.
Contributing.
So once that card gets made, then it's accessioned. Sometimes it's digitized. That's another thing that we're doing now to try to make communication between botanists and other interested individuals who work in this area able to do research without having to travel so much, in many cases not having to handle precious specimens, generally make it easy to study. Those digitized specimens are recorded at the Alabama Plant Atlas that can be accessed online.
Okay.
Individual can just type in Alabama Plant Atlas and the website should come up.
Great. So here in Alabama, we are number 4 in the country for diversity. Ahead of us, California, Texas, I think it's Arizona, and then New Mexico, I think, is right below us. Because we have so many diverse habitats in Alabama. So we have all those little streams, we have mountains, we have the Piedmont, we have the coastal plain, we have the actual beach. So we have all this wonderful diversity here in Alabama. 28 endemic plant species that are found. Endemic means found nowhere else in the world. And you said, I believe, there are 23 listed as endangered or
threatened.
Threatened, yes. So, you know, you're all part of the team that tries to keep that diversity precious. So
we try.
Yes, yes. 4,500 plant species in Alabama.
And rising.
Yes. As you look more closely, you find more plant species.
In fact, many of those, not many, but several of those plant species, they were actually collected years ago and misidentified as another more common species. And because of technology and more ways to communicate and
DNA.
Study, we mm-hmm. are now able to take some of these plants that we call indents. We know what genus they are, but we don't know what species, and we'll put them in this special folder in the mm-hmm. herbarium case. And occasionally somebody who knows a lot about that particular genus might come through and spend a week or so in the herbarium studying. And lo and behold, you find out you have a plant that has not been documented before yeah. in our state.
So this is, to me, a fascinating field for any type of living thing. We talked about insects, we talked about birds, and here we are with plants, keeping records of what is here now that may not be here later and that some future scientist may be interested in. Thank you so much for coming today, Lynn. I think this has been wonderful, very interesting.
You're so welcome. I'm glad to be here.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. We will do another one next month. Thank you and have a good day.
You've been listening to Talking Dirty at the Library, a podcast produced by the Athens Limestone County Public Library in cooperation with the Limestone County Extension Office and Master Gardener Program. Join us next time to see where we're growing. And to hear other recordings from our Library Voices podcast series, please visit the Athens Limestone County Library website at alcpl.org.